our next presenter, who is Selena Stewart. There you are. Hello. Who is going to speak to us about historical barriers to the ballot box, past, present, and the work of fixing it. Selena Stewart describes herself as a passport pilgrim, a Vogue attorney, an expert home chef, and a cultural provocateur. She is chief counsel and senior director of advocacy and litigation for the League of Women Voters of the United States. She develops and implements League political strategies and policy positions around election reform and voting rights, oversees litigation for the national and state leagues, works closely with grassroots staff in implementing a national agenda, strengthens relationships and visibility of the League on the Hill, and oversees the People-Powered Fair Maps initiative. Prior to joining the League, she was acting chief operating officer and director of philanthropy at an electoral reform nonprofit. Additionally, she served as a litigation consultant to several M100 law firms, as legislative aide at the Michigan legislature, and as legal counsel to minority leader Stacey Abrams at the Georgia House of Representatives. Selena Stewart earned her JD from Western Michigan University Law School and her BA in sociology from Spelman College. She has served on the boards of the Bar Association of DC, the Women's Bar Association of DC, the National Association of Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, DC, and she was an American Bar Foundation Law Practice Fellow. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here with everybody today. Again, my name is Selena Stewart, and I'm currently serving as chief counsel and senior director of advocacy and litigation at the League, the national office. And so I'm really pleased to join everyone today. I feel like we're in really extraordinary times politically, but the barriers that we see really are not new. I think we think of them as new because we're living in this current time, but they're not. And in fact, I like to think about what's happening now as the same shenanigans in an updated costume. And so today I want to talk about some of the historical barriers to the ballot box. And I also want to add some flavor to what we already know about the topic by infusing some of the work that the League has done and other voting rights organizations while throughout this presentation. I do want to offer a special thanks to Richard and the entire conference team at Visioning a Better America for this wonderful conference with such dynamic speakers and information throughout this week. And I hope that when we're all finished, that we all have more information to define what our own vision for a better country means to each of us, and that we can gather with like-minded people and working to achieve it for the next however many years it takes for us to get to that vision. So let's take a little walk down some dark and lit roads to talk about it. So barriers to the ballot box, as I said, are not new. They've been around since the origin of voting, really, and it has just really taken twists and turns as more individuals enter the franchise. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which was drafted in 1868, granted African Americans the right to citizenship. However, African Americans didn't always translate into the ability to vote. Black voters were systematically turned away from state polling places. And so to combat this, Congress passed the 15th Amendment in 1870, which says, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude." And that's a really interesting, I find that fascinating, the 15th Amendment, language within the 15th Amendment. Yet still, states still found ways to circumvent the Constitution and prevent Blacks from voting. Poll taxes, literacy tests, fraud, and intimidation, all of these things really were barriers to African Americans to getting into the polls. And that was until the Supreme Court struck down in 1915 what is called the Grandfather Clause. And this was really to keep descendants of slaves out of elections. The clause said that you could not vote unless your grandfather had voted. And for many, many African Americans during that time, it was just a mere impossibility, just impossible to pass that test, especially if your ancestors were slaves, as many African American people were. So this unfair treatment was debated on the streets, in Congress, and also in the press. A full 50 years after the 15th Amendment passed, Black Americans still found it difficult to vote, especially in the South. And we see that still happening today, right? But, you know, that list has grown a little bit, I think. There were just so many barriers to people being able to vote and understanding their right to vote and whether they could vote. So the fight for suffrage raged on for decades. We're still in this fight now. In the 1930s, there was a man in Georgia who described the situation as, "Do you know I've never voted in my life, never been able to exercise my right as a citizen because of the poll tax. I can't pay a poll tax. I can't have my voice in my own government." And so poll taxes essentially were a tax that people had to pay prior to being allowed to vote. You would see signs that say, "Pay your poll tax by January 31st, be a good citizen." Whereas that poll tax, you know, didn't apply to everyone. It certainly didn't apply in the same way. And so there are so many people who felt that they couldn't have their voice in government simply because they couldn't afford to. So meanwhile, during that time, the League had launched, and our founder, Carrie Chapman Catt, had the very ambitious goal to enfranchise 10 million women to vote. At the time, that equated to about half of the female population in the country, voting age population in the country, which is like astronomical to think of it now with no internet and just phones and things like that. But if we fast forward a couple of decades and demonstrators marching in the streets holding signs during the March on Washington in 1963, many of these people so brave and passionate about voting and equality and trying to establish and reassert their equality in this country. So in 1963 and 64, this is all stuff we probably know. Dr. Martin Luther King brought hundreds of African Americans to the courthouse in Selma, Alabama, to register. When they were turned away, Dr. King organized and led protests that finally turned the tide of the American political will. In 1964, the 24th Amendment prohibited the use of poll taxes. So you could no longer charge an individual in order for them to have the ability to vote. And then, of course, in 1965, one of the most transformational pieces of legislation passed in Congress, and it was the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which directed the Attorney General to enforce the right to vote specifically for African Americans in this country. And so in 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was created, a significant change in the status of African Americans happened throughout the South. The Voting Rights Act prohibited states from using literacy tests and other methods of exclusion for African Americans from voting. Prior to this, only an estimated 20 or 20 so percent of voting age Blacks were registered nationally. But by 1969, just 4 years after the act, the number had jumped to 61%. So that tells us a few things. One, very similar to what we saw even in 2020, when voting access and participation is increased, when the barriers are mitigated or lowered, so many more people turn out and exercise their right to vote. And so I think that's just critically important to think about the relationship between voting access and voter turnout and participation. So in 1970, this is where the League really started to turn our focus from just women's right to vote and enfranchising women specifically, to starting to understand why we also had to support the fight for African Americans' right to vote in this country as well, and how critical it was for all of us to have access to the ballot. Okay, so I want to talk about now some historical barriers that we still see now. We've talked about the past and what existed and what was eliminated or expanded through different laws in this country. But I think it's also important to talk about what's happening right now. So let's talk about a few of the barriers that I see, at least in my job as chief counsel at the league. So one of the things that we're seeing a lot of is strict voter ID requirements. So election officials often use false claims of rampant voter fraud to justify strict requirements like a photo ID, often aimed at suppressing the votes of people of color and younger voters, or at least that's the trend that we see. That's the folks who it impacts most. Black folks, brown folks, young folks, poor or income sensitive folks, mostly in urban areas. So laws requiring a physical street address discriminate against groups that are more likely to have a P.O. box. And what if you don't have a residence at all? Not having a residence doesn't prohibit you from actually voting. And we saw a lot of situations with Native American reservations because they don't, on the reservation, one, everyone's mail is collected in the same way. They may not be on a postal, a standard postal route, et cetera. And in many instances, there's a person or a couple of people who collect people's ballots, turn it into the local election official. And even those things were restricted during 20 or attempts to restrict that during the 2020 election. We also see voter roll purges. So really, I think everyone agrees that we want clean rolls. We want to make sure that election officials have access to the individuals who are registered to vote. The problem is that what we've seen across the country is there being these aggressive voter purges where the data is not good, essentially. So what we've seen is, for example, there may be a state that wants to eliminate all Richard Browns. Understanding that that may be a common name for many people, there was no distinction between Richard A. Brown versus Richard V. Brown. And so all Richard Browns would be purged on that list. And so you had so many people who were eligible to vote, had done what they were supposed to in registering, and were showing up to polls unable to vote. And so when you have that barrier in place and in the state, it doesn't have like a same day registration or automatic voter registration option, then that person is just shut out of the election. And so we want to make sure we avoid situations like that, of course. And so I think for us, the thing is making sure that all voter list maintenance is maintained and done in compliance with the National Voter Registration Act and ensuring that people have an opportunity to cure or to fix whatever issues have come up with their registration so they can be qualified and eligible to vote on election day. Other issues that we've seen include polling place closures and consolidations. In a recent US Today report, they found that election officials have closed thousands of polling places, largely affecting communities of color. Often this was happening without any notice. You would, like most people, you get your voter registration card, you know where your polling place, you get all of that stuff in the mail saying, hey, here's election day, here's where you're voting. And then on election day, when you may want to drop your ballot or maybe you're going into the facility to execute your ballot, there's a sign on the door that says, this polling place closed. And oftentimes these signs didn't even indicate where a person was supposed to go. So you had voters who may have been trying to get voting done pretty quickly before they go to work in the morning or after work, and the polling place is closed without any remedy or any place to go in order to execute their ballot. And so if they did go to another polling site, they had to execute or fill out a provisional ballot, which we want to avoid that. We want people to actually be able to fill out their ballot, turn it in, and put it in a box to be counted. Other issues that we've seen include reduced early voting. So there are some states and localities who have long used early voting to reduce election day crunch, which happens, right? You allow people to vote early so that on election day, the lines are shorter, people can move through more quickly, et cetera. We saw that in 2020 where more people voted during the early voting period than on election day, or just as much really. And so to not open up that process to prospective voters, really who were bound by work or other commitments, made it really tough for people to vote. And so we've seen that not only in 2020, we saw that in 2018, we saw that in 2016, we saw that in 2014 in certain states across the South. Faith-based groups have also used early voting for a nonpartisan get out the vote effort. The League is also nonpartisan, so we participate in a variety of activities, whether that is through churches, fairs, also on National Voter Registration Day that happens every September, where we just get out and encourage people to get registered and also be prepared to vote. Recently, officials across the nation have really curtailed early voting, largely, again, hitting communities of color and those communities that have less resources than others. Yet another issue that we've seen is reduced voting hours. Limiting early voting, reducing voting hours can make voting less convenient and even impossible for some people, for so many voters or millions of voters around the country. So even things like closing the polling place, if the normal hours were from 6 a.m. till 8 p.m., by saying that now we're only going to be open from 9 a.m. till 6 a.m., that means that people who work during those hours cannot do that. People with non-traditional work hours, it makes it nearly impossible for them to execute their ballot on election day if that's what they need to do. And so one of the arguments that we've heard is, oh, it's just an hour, it's just 2 hours, one on the back end, one on the front end. But it makes such a huge difference to voters who need as much flexibility in order to execute their ballot. So what is the League's role in all this? So the League had one of our heaviest litigation cycles with more than 70 lawsuits, and many of them dealing with these very issues throughout 2018 and 2016 election. For the 2020 cycle, our litigation focused on expanding voting access via extending voting hours and early voting periods, but also making sure that during the pandemic, voters did not have to choose between exercising their constitutional right and their health and safety. We also challenged voter ID laws, like in Kentucky and other places, where restrictive laws were pushed through the legislature just months before the general election. And we did have some success, because I know this can be really dreary, right? We're talking about all these barriers, but there is some light at the end of the tunnel. Our success in 2020 alone, we had hundreds of lawyers who just stepped up and law firms from the country to step up and help protect more than 25 million voters between March 2020 and November of 2020. So during that election cycle, we had litigation in more than 37 states, and we expanded access to voting and promoted greater participation across the country. And so we're really proud of that piece, because it's not easy. It takes a lot of long hours and a lot of people really getting into the dirt, rolling up their sleeves in order to get this accomplished. And then I just want to finish with a few things about fixing it. So we've talked about the historical barriers. We've talked about the barriers that are still in place now. But I think it's important to also focus on, how do we fix it? How do we come together and start to fix these things for so many people, including ourselves? In 2019, there was a massive purge in Ohio. And our state executive director was actually on that purge list, even though she had voted for in the last 10 elections. I don't want to give her age, you know, be diplomatic here. But she had been voting for the last 10 elections, and she was suddenly on this purge list. And so for me, I think it's so important to talk about not only the problem, but how do we fix it? How do we move forward? So how do you be a super voter? We have this great resource called Vote 411, which is year-round service, basically. And we reach out to candidates and ask them questions that the community has elevated. So how do you feel about healthcare? How do you feel about housing? What are you going to do to fix potholes? What are you going to do to make sure that our kids are properly educated? And so we put those in a voter's guide and reach out to candidates. And this is a down ballot. So everyone from the president, state, and local municipalities can answer these questions. And we think this is such a valuable resource for voters, especially if you're a new voter or if you're just haven't voted in a while and you're getting reintroduced to the franchise, for you to know what these folks are campaigning around. Now, we don't care, honestly, who people vote for. That's not the League's focus. Our focus is really giving people the information to make informed decisions about their voting plan. And so we want to provide each person information to make their own decision. Who aligns with my community best? Who aligns with my own values? And be able to pick those people. And even before I came to the league, I was using this resource just because, one, you could do it on your phone. Two, you could save your choices. And then when I went to the ballot box, I was like, so easy. I'm like, check, 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 check. It was great. So that was one resource I think that people can use in order to figure out, one, how to just be more educated about the people on the ballot. So what can we all do? I think the first thing is check your registration status early. I check mine every year just to make sure for some reason my name hasn't shown up on a list. And I also check my mom and my daddy's too, because they're in their 70s and, you know, sometimes, you know, things happen. So I just make sure I check registration status early and also verify where I'm voting and things like that, making a plan early. And then the second thing is actually showing up to vote, whether it's on election day or whether you choose to vote before, during the early period. Take the time to make your voting plan and actually execute your ballot. And I even say a step further, which is encourage, making sure your family and friends. I'm so glad that none of my family and friends are on here, or maybe my friends are on here, I don't know. But my family, because I harass them. They call it harassment. I just call it my civic duty. To make sure that they are voting and that they have made a voting plan for themselves and that they're educated about who their candidates are in their community. And so I'm not only going to make sure my ballot is executed, but I'm making sure that everyone in my family also has a voting plan and my friends as well. I'm fortunate that, you know, I come from a voting family. I remember going into the booth with my parents as a young girl. I don't want to age myself, but when I was young, when I first started voting, you went into a booth, closed, filled out a little form or hit a button on a computer. But it was that experience for me in going into a booth, understanding how important it was to vote, but also knowing that no one would ever see what my vote was because it was so private. And then finally, engaging with election officials once they are elected. I think it is so critical for people to know and understand that regardless of who you wanted to be elected, maybe they won, maybe they didn't. Once a person is elected, they represent us all in that particular community, whether that's our local city attorney, or whether it's our state representative, whether our state senator, whether it's our federal legislators, they represent us all and they answer to us. And so I just continue to tell people, you know, everyone's not like me. You don't work at a voting rights organization every day where this is just your work. But even if you're not, even before I joined a voting rights organization, I was always involved in the community that I felt represented my interests. So that's part of the reason why I was part of NAACP and other organizations, because I knew that they were fighting for the things that aligned with what I wanted. So even if I could not make that my day job, I had people who were fighting the fight on my behalf, regardless. And so I think that's so important to find ways to engage, whether, again, that's reaching out to your local official or whoever via a letter, a phone call, or just joining a group that you know is advocating for things that are important to you. So with that, I will turn it over. I want to leave some time for questions if people have it. And I think I'm right at 25 minutes or so.